evening. It is Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. As COVID-19 continues its rampage, here is today's update for the United States. 827,038 confirmed cases, 75,528 recovered, and unfortunately 45,525 deaths. According to Reuters, recovered almost. China's early patients unable to shed coronavirus. Chinese doctors in Wuhan, where the virus first emerged in December, say a growing number of cases in which people recover from the virus but continue to test positive without showing symptoms is one of their biggest challenges as the country moves into a new phase of its contaminant battle. This while the director of the CDC, Robert Redfield, warns that a second wave of coronavirus is likely to be even more devastating. What are we to make of all of this? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guest. She's a physician and co-editor of Popular Resistance, Dr. Margaret Flowers. As always, Margaret, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So the plight of Wuhan's long-term patients underlines how much remains unknown about COVID-19 and why it appears to affect different people in numerous ways. There are people in China who tested negative for the virus at some point after recovering, but then tested positive again, some up to 70 days later. Many have done so over 50 to 60 days. The prospect of people remaining positive for the virus and therefore potentially infectious remains a serious concern as more people here seek to end lockdowns and resume economic activity. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it is absolutely a concern. They're seeing the same thing in South Korea as well. They're seeing actually also cases where people are hospitalized for COVID-19 with symptoms, are treated, then are sent home, and then relapse. And their theory is that they've cleared enough of the bacteria, not the bacteria, I'm sorry, enough of the virus, that it's below the level that can be detected by the tests, but they haven't cleared it completely from their bodies. And so as they go home and they're no longer being treated, it starts to grow again in the body until it becomes up to a point where it can be detected again. I can't say if that's what is happening in China. It's likely, but it is very early for us. We're still learning every day so much more about this virus. And it does, you know, raise concern that we already know about 50 to 80 or 75% of people who test positive for COVID-19 don't show symptoms. It's believed that they're infectious, and people are very infectious in the days before they show symptoms. So there's, you know, this is why this is a pandemic. It's a highly infectious virus. It's new. We don't know much about it. It's why we need to be so careful about how we go about reopening schools and businesses, making sure that before we do that, we know, you know, what to expect, and we have the infrastructure in place to monitor and handle any outbreaks that occur.
To that point, CDC Director Robert Redfield said, quote, "There's a possibility that the assault of the virus on our nation next winter will actually be even more difficult than the one we just went." And when I've said this to others, they kind of put their head back. They don't understand what I mean. We're going to have the flu epidemic and the coronavirus epidemic at the same time, according to Redfield. But Margaret, I'm hearing experts say that actually what Redfield is talking about would really be the third wave. They're saying, others are saying that the second wave is going to come in the late summer.
Well, we're not even out of the first wave, so I don't know when the second wave is going to come, but we can't expect that there are going to be waves. I mean, even as the cases start to decline and we start to open things back up, the COVID-19 is still going to be out there. The virus is still going to be out there. And, you know, the more that people are interacting, the more likely that it can spread and we can get another wave again. Typically with pandemics, there are several waves. You can't really predict exactly how those waves are going to go. The virus changes over time. Sometimes it could become milder. In many cases, it becomes more severe. But I think that Dr. Redfield is right. Looking at the wintertime, you know, when this hit in the United States, it was really coming at the tail end of the flu season. Those cases were declining as this rose. We typically do see an increase in hospitalizations during the flu season, never anything even near what we've been seeing in places like New York City with COVID-19. But imagine a typical flu season, you know, having an increased use of healthcare, you know, offices and hospitals, and then having this also on top of that, it's just going to make it more difficult.
The CDC, Redfield, again, they've drafted guidelines for state and local governments on how they can, quote, ease mitigation efforts, moving from drastic restrictions such as stay-at-home orders in a phased way to support a safe reopening. Understanding Americans' sense of individualism and entitlement and invincibility, is there such a thing as easing mitigation efforts, a safe reopening right now without extensive testing and antibody testing? I was listening today to CNN, and the Las Vegas mayor, Carolyn Goodman, she's pushing for the casinos in Vegas to reopen. And I'm listening to this woman saying that would be the worst thing in terms of casinos and people coming from all over the country. And all, I didn't understand it, but she's hell bent on trying to get the casinos in Vegas to reopen.
Yeah, it makes absolutely no sense right now to be moving in that direction when we don't even have, you know, a handle. Like you reported the numbers of cases at the top of the hour, but we know that that's a huge underestimation of the number of cases that actually exist. And with so many people being asymptomatic and potentially being able to spread this, and this is something that spreads through the air. So people can just be in a closed space and they don't even have to cough on you. Just breathing that same air, you may breathe in the virus and it just needs to go into your throat or into your nose to latch on and, you know, start an infection. Unlike some of the more severe viruses like SARS and MERS, which really you had to have a very close contact and had to get down and deep into your lungs. This is a highly infectious virus. So until we, you know, have, they're talking about hiring hundreds of thousands of people to be doing monitoring, you know, looking up contacts. We need to be having teams that are out, you know, cleaning stores and public spaces regularly. You know, we need to have easy testing, free and available. There's a lot of infrastructure that we have to put in place if we want to open back up, you know, safely. And, you know, remember that this is, you know, what we experienced with this, you know, going into isolation or physical distancing, you know, we kind of caught it early, hopefully, and tried to abate this a little bit. But if we go back out in mass, we could see a huge number of cases, more than we're experiencing right now.
Anderson Cooper, during this interview with Las Vegas Mayor Carolyn Goodman, he showed a schematic of a restaurant in China where he was demonstrating how one person had the virus and how all of these other people in the restaurant, he was showing a seating chart, how all and where these people were sitting relative to the person that was infected. And it wound up being something like 12 or 15 people in this restaurant wound up getting sick and talking about it traveling through the air conditioning system. And all that Vegas Mayor Goodman could say was, well, that's the same thing that happened to the Legionnaires' disease. It came through the. I said, "Lady, that's not smart." In fact, Anderson Cooper said, "That's a really ignorant thing for you to say." But before we run up against the time here, the other thing I wanted to get your take on is, at least two people. It's been reported now. At least two people died in mid-February had contracted novel coronavirus, according to health officials in California, signaling that the virus may have spread, been fatal in the U.S. weeks earlier than previously thought. We all thought that it started in Washington State. What does this new data tell us?
Yeah, I think that that just kind of adds to the other data that we've been seeing that shows that there was a spike of these unusual viral pneumonias in early February. And, you know, so it looks like, and because we weren't doing any screening of people coming into the country early when we should have. We knew about the virus in January, early January, and so many people are asymptomatic with it. It's very likely that it was all throughout the country before we actually started seeing cases that were diagnosed, because remember, you know, we didn't have tests to really be able to test people early on. So, yes, I think that this shows that it's pretty widespread out there, and again, you know, just underscores why we should have taken this seriously early on, as many other countries did.
We have just about a minute left. What does this do to the modeling? Because as I understand it, modeling for epidemics relies heavily on understanding the start date of an outbreak. So when you push back this start date, what does it do to the modeling?
Well, I imagine that it would make it What you're assuming if you start with a later start date is that it's, you know, contained to one area and it's spreading out from there. To now understand that it was starting earlier means that the spread started earlier, and I think would make the modeling be kind of a larger, that we expect that there's a larger number of cases out there based on this information.
Dr. Margaret Flowers, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Iran launches its first military satellite. Iran's Revolutionary Guard deployed a Ghassid satellite carrier to put the device into space, a previously unheard-of system. While amid the coronavirus failures of his administration, Trump threatens an act of war with order to shoot down Iranian boats. How significant is this satellite deployment, and have we seen this movie before? Was it called The Gulf of Tonkin? Maybe it was called The Sinking of the Maine. Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He holds the Moores Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's one of the most prolific writers of our time. His latest book is Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. Dr. Gerald Horn, as always, Gerald, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
So Iran has announced that it successfully launched the country's first military reconnaissance satellite after a number of failures. First, is Iran within its rights as a sovereign nation to do so? Iran maintains it has no intention of acquiring nuclear weapons and says its aerospace activities are peaceful and comply with a United Nations Security Council resolution. Your thoughts?
Well, I happened to catch the press conference held by Secretary of State Michael Pompeo this afternoon, and he certainly disagreed with the Iranian evaluation. He says that this is in violation of various United Nations resolutions, which is quite rich coming from Washington in light of the fact that Washington has sought to break out of the nuclear accord negotiated so painstakingly by the previous administration. In fact, at one of his recent press conferences, President Trump suggested that Secretary of State John Kerry is in violation of the Logan Act. That is to say, he's seeking, says Mr. Trump, to encourage the Iranians not to go along with Mr. Trump on the premise that they'll get a better deal if Biden is elected in November. In any case, the Iranians suggest that this was for civilian purposes. Mr. Pompeo countered that he did not agree. And in fact, he pointed out something that I consider to be unrelated, although apparently he does not, that his counterpart, the Iranian foreign minister, was in Syria as he was speaking in Washington. And in any case, I agree with those who suggest that what Mr. Trump is engaged in is the mother of all distractions when he is trying to distract attention away from his ham-fisted approach to dealing with a globe-circling pandemic by raising various kinds of red herrings, including first suggesting that he was going to ban all immigration, and then after an explosion of opposition from various business interests, reduces that to trying to keep out the new green card holders, and now threatening war, because that's what it basically amounts to when he talks about shooting Iranian vessels, threatening war with Iran. Now, on the one hand, I think it's fair to say that a beast is most dangerous and most irrational when it's cornered. And to a certain degree, the United States is cornered, unable to deal with a pandemic that's killing thousands, which is basically shrinking the already shriveled U.S. reputation globally. But at the same time, I think that in light of the fact that Mr. Trump basically engaged in state-sponsored assassination a few months ago when he killed the top Iranian official, Mr. Soleimani, while he happened to be visiting in Iraq, and then, of course, the Iranians retaliated by sending missiles into a U.S. base in Iraq, which has led to some brain injuries, I'm afraid to say, for U.S. soldiers. So I think, all in all, this is a very dangerous and perilous moment that we're now facing.
The United States alleges that this satellite program is a cover for missile development. If a country is able to successfully launch a satellite into orbit with a two-stage launcher, the delivery mechanism, to me, must be fairly developed. I don't know how much cover that is. Seems to me as though it's hiding in plain sight.
Well, clearly, Mr. Trump is playing with fire, and apparently he's making the mistake that I'm afraid many losers in international conflicts have made over the decades and centuries. That is to say, underestimating the potential of his so-called adversary. The Iranians and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, according to Mr. Pompeo, have succeeded in sending this satellite into space, hundreds of miles into the ionosphere, into the stratosphere. This bespeaks a certain kind of technological and scientific sophistication. We already know that Iran has been accused, I'm afraid to say, of hacking into computers in the United States of America, which also bespeaks a certain sophistication. And so when Mr. Trump begins to rattle his saber, a threatening conflict with Iran, I just trust and hope that he knows what he's getting into. But as someone who watches his press conferences on a regular basis, I'm afraid to say that Mr. Trump oftentimes strikes out irrationally, particularly as those who seem to challenge him, which, of course, is the forte of the classic bully.
The IRGC, the Iranian Guard, called it the first military satellite ever launched by Tehran. It used a Ghassid or messenger satellite carrier to put the device into space, which is touted as a previously unheard-of system. So two things. One, a previously unheard-of system, that to me questions the United States intelligence apparatus. And then also the question is this a demonstration of the failure of the U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran?
Well, the second question is easy to answer, and the answer to that is yes. This so-called maximum pressure campaign was a substitute for the negotiations entered into by the previous administration. Supposedly, it was going to intimidate, frighten, if not deter, Iran. Apparently, it has not, as the satellite launch tends to suggest. But I think still that it is well for us to keep a close and careful eye on what's going on in that part of the world. Just today, the New York Times reported that there are tensions on the border between Iraq and Iran. I think that to a degree, you can say that Washington is putting pressure on Baghdad to heighten tensions against Iran. Baghdad, in response, says that Iran has a spectacular number of coronavirus infections, and it's trying to keep Iranians out of Iraq for health purposes. I'm not so sure about that, given how dependent Iraq is on the economy of Iran. But in any case, if you paid attention to that press conference by Mr. Pompeo today, I'm sure alarm bells were going off in the peace community all over the world, because not only was he threatening conflict with Iran, he was also threatening conflict with one of Iran's major supporters, speaking of the People's Republic of China. And that, of course, brings us to the pivotal role of the European Union. Recall that Germany, France, and UK were very important in negotiating this nuclear accord with Iran. Supposedly, they were unhappy when Mr. Trump has sought to break that accord. At the same time, they have apparently been trying to install a mechanism whereby trade could be effectuated with Iran so that Iran could draw some benefits from this accord, even though the U.S. has walked away from this accord. And even Mr. Trump has suggested that he would not be opposed to more medical aid going to Iran in light of the COVID-19 disease, which is sweeping through that country. Supposedly, the EU3, as they're called, France, Germany, and UK, have been sending medical materiel to Iran, but apparently it has not been sufficient to arrest this disease.
Speaking of the COVID-19 and failures in this country, the president is threatening war by threatening to shoot down Iranian boats. Now, the president tweeted today, this morning, that he has instructed the U.S. Navy to shoot down and destroy Iranian vessels that harass American warships in the Persian Gulf. Quote, "I have instructed the United States Navy to shoot down and destroy any and all Iranian gunboats if they harass our ships at sea." Dr. Horn, this concerns me a lot more than the satellite launch, because this indicates that Iran has flying boats, and that scares me. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure how to respond, but I will say this, that I think with regard to those threats that Mr. Trump has just issued, pay careful and close attention to contrasting news. That is to say, certain Pentagon officials have suggested that COVID-19 is cutting a swath through Navy personnel. Recall that what has befallen the so-called Big Stick, the aircraft carrier, the Theodore Roosevelt, which has 5,000 U.S. sailors jammed together, about 12% minimally of those sailors have been diagnosed as having the virus. Many of them are now in hospital in Guam, which has caused an outcry amongst that U.S. colonial possession. But in any case, other officials have suggested that it might be well past time to basically put in dry dock a good deal of the U.S. fleet because of this disease and to have massive testing. Recall that in France, the Charles de Gaulle, which is the French equivalent of the Theodore Roosevelt, that's what basically they've done. And rather than issue empty threats when his Navy might be in dry dock, Mr. Trump would be well advised to extend the olive branch of peace and negotiation to his Iranian counterparts before he tries to open the gates of hell.
And to your point about dry dock, this all as the $13 billion Gerald Ford has been launched, and they've got a serious problem with their toilets, which costs them $400,000 every time the system gets clogged and they need to flush their toilets, and which I don't think you want to have on a ship. If COVID-19 makes its way to the Ford, you don't want to have a toilet problem on your aircraft carrier.
Well, certainly not with the attendant diarrhea, which tends to accompany often this COVID-19 and coronavirus. But this, in many ways, bespeaks what depths U.S. imperialism has sunk to. That is to say, here you have the president who has stood idly by as a pandemic sweeps throughout his country, cutting an incredible swath of destruction between the amongst the black community and the brown community in particular. And rather than devote all of his waking hours to trying to arrest this pandemic that has devastated his country, instead, he's trying to throw dust in the eyes of the international community and distract his own beleaguered population from his many failures by issuing these empty and vacuous threats.
To that point, and we've got just about 45 seconds left, and as I mentioned in the opening, as the president has directed the Navy to shoot down and destroy Iranian vessels, all gunboats, again, shooting down Iranian flying boats, is this, have we seen this movie before? Is this the president trying to take us back to the Gulf of Tonkin?
Well, most certainly. Or as you put it at the top, remember the Maine from the War of 1898 that led to the United States toppling the tottering Spanish Empire and seizing in the process rule of Cuba and Puerto Rico. We've seen this movie before, and I'm afraid to say that this time it will only end in tears.
Dr. Gerald Horn, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. In a first, Missouri sues China over coronavirus economic losses. Yesterday, Missouri became the first U.S. state to sue the Chinese government over its handling of the coronavirus, saying that China's response to the outbreak that originated in the city of Wuhan brought devastating economic losses to the state. Is this the perfect example of a frivolous lawsuit that has no legal merit, no basis in fact or law? Are these allies of President Trump taking their anti-China public relations blitz to new heights of absurdity? Or could there be something here? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's an American human rights, labor rights lawyer, and peace activist, author of the new book, No More War: How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interest. Dan Kovalik, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
So we have Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt alleging in his suit that China's response to the outbreak that originated in the city of Wuhan brought devastating economic losses to the state of Missouri. He alleges negligence and claims that Missouri and its residents suffered possibly tens of billions of dollars in economic damages and seeks cash compensation. Quote, "The Chinese government lied to the world about the danger and contagious nature of COVID-19, silenced whistleblowers, and did little to stop the spread of the disease." State Attorney General Schmidt is a Republican, but it sounds more like he's talking about Donald Trump than President Xi. Anyway, your thoughts about Missouri's suit?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways in which the suit is just absurd. I mean, first of all, to sue someone for negligence, you have to be able to allege that that person, or in this case, an entire country, China, owed you some duty of care, which I think is probably a difficult thing to do. I can't even conceive of how that would be possible. But also, you know, the facts are that China did a pretty good job containing the virus. You know, they actually engaged in what some people think were pretty draconian measures in terms of the lockdown procedures they put in place in the province, and it worked. And now they're sending masks around the world, of course. The U.S. is buying masks and other supplies from China, as are a lot of other countries.
Even ventilators, Chinese ventilators wound up in Los Angeles recently, within a couple of weeks.
Yeah, right. Now states are just going on their own and buying these sorts of things from China. So, you know, there's no allegation that whatever happened, that China did anything on purpose. And in fact, as I said, it appears they did a pretty good job. And now things are returning to relative normal and calm in China. I think you touched on the problem. The problem is that it was Donald Trump who really failed the American people here. He dithered for at least 6 weeks when, you know, he should have been engaging in social, you know, encouraging social distancing measures, getting supplies to people, to hospitals. He did none of that. And we're in the place we're in right now because of those critical 6 weeks he lost for us. And because of other things, for example, because in 2018, he got rid of our pandemic panel that Obama had set up. So the point is that now Trump and his allies, knowing that they have failed, are trying to find a scapegoat. And China is, in this case, a convenient scapegoat.
This would be a civil suit, not a criminal suit. So let me ask you just another procedural question, which you touched on. But so who would the plaintiff in this actually be? Would it be as the country of China? Would it be President Xi Jinping? Because if Xi Jinping is named as the plaintiff, as the president of China, the things that you just articulated about the failures of Donald Trump, I would think, would be the first rebuttal that would be presented, really highlighting the failures of the American government as opposed to mitigating the problem here in the United States.
Yes. Well, again, if we looked at this as kind of a standard tort case, and that's what kind of case this is, a case for personal injury, you would have something called contributory negligence. That is to say, that the person, the plaintiff in this case, I guess it's the state of Missouri, China could say, well, there's huge contributory negligence because whatever we did, the fact is what Trump did was really the but-for cause of your woes, not our conduct. Mm-hmm. And therefore, right, therefore we win.
And oh, by the way, as a Chinese government, to your initial point, we owe you no duty because we're China, not the United States.
Exactly. I mean, I've never heard of such a lawsuit. I don't know how this could get any farther than a motion to dismiss at best. I mean, no one from China will probably show up to even defend it. It is a political stunt is what it is. And it is a tactic to deflect blame from where it should be being placed, and that is the White House.
Now, it's interesting to me that, again, Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt has filed a suit. Mississippi has announced plans to file a suit against China in a seemingly similar manner. That's the state's attorney, Lynn Fitch, said, too many Mississippians have suffered as a result of China's cover-up. And then we also have, I believe, Senator Tom Cotton, Republican from Arkansas, and Representative Dan Crenshaw, Republican from Texas. They've introduced legislation that would allow Americans to sue Beijing in an effort to recover damages. So this really seems to be kind of taken on a life of its own. And I'm trying to still figure out, understanding the doctrine of sovereign immunity, how a foreign government gets sued in a case of this manner in a U.S. court.
Well, that's another point. There is an issue with sovereign immunity here, which may, again, be a very good defense of China. The other defense would be something called the act of state doctrine. The Supreme Court held in the early 1960s, actually in cases involving the revolutionary government of Cuba, who a number of property holders who lost property during the socialist revolution tried to sue Cuba for nationalizing their property. in the Supreme Court of the United States held that what Cuba did in that instance was a so-called act of state, and you can't sue another state for that. So there's many different defenses here that China would have to this suit. Again, I don't see, though, that anyone could believe that a suit like this could go forward, given, you know, it wouldn't even get to those defenses. Let's just put it that way. But again, clearly this is a means to protect the White House politically. Obviously, during an election year in November, Trump will be held to account for what he's done and not done during this crisis. And as it stands, it doesn't look very good for him.
You know, you mentioned a minute or so ago that you didn't even expect that a representative of China, of the Chinese government, would show up in court to defend themselves. That just takes me back to Mueller, the Mueller investigation, and he sued four Russian companies, not expecting them to show up. They showed up asking for discovery, and that just threw Mueller into a total fit. Not now knowing what to do. I didn't expect you guys to show. Now you have, kind of thing. So it wouldn't surprise me if some representatives of the Chinese government showed up in U.S. court. I just throw that out as a side note. Max Blumenthal in the Gray Zone wrote a story about the allies of President Trump taking their anti-China public relations blitz to new heights. And one of the main reasons why I mentioned the political affiliation of those that are bringing forth this suit is because of Max's article. And so this really seems, you've got the Washington Times, Fox News, the Washington Post, they were all running with this story that COVID-19 was a creation in a Wuhan, China laboratory and that it ran amok. And you then even had Pompeo and the president fanning these flames, as well as Chris Hayes on MSNBC. So this really just seems to be another iteration of that effort. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, and I've noticed that too. I listen to NPR every morning, and they, for a time, have been pushing that line as well. And again, I think it's very dangerous. There's no evidence that this virus even originated in any lab. You know, scientists are pretty certain that it was a naturally occurring virus, probably did originate in these wet markets in China. But again, this is really a way really to militarize this issue, right? I mean, because the claim that it originated in a Chinese laboratory obviously raises the specter of biological warfare and really primes the U.S. population for a potential military confrontation with China. And I think, frankly, there is a desire among some of the elite to have that type of confrontation. I saw recently, in fact, the Pentagon is very open about the fact that it is now organizing itself primarily for a confrontation with China and mm-hmm. with Russia as well. That yes. They're pivoting away from the Middle East, pivoting towards the East, towards China, towards Russia. And again, I think that this anti-Chinese rhetoric is a means to prep the population for such a possibility.
And to your point about a rebuttal regarding the nature of the development of the coronavirus and whether it was created in a lab, there was an open letter by a group of 27 public health scientists from 8 countries in March that was published in Lancet, the medical journal, issuing support to scientists and health professionals in China and strongly condemning the conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin. So to your point, there are a number of individuals that have come out opposing this ridiculous theory. And just final point, as you talk about weaponizing COVID-19 and that this would be biological warfare, I have said a number of times that I believe that the way that the United States is using sanctions against countries in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic, making it more difficult, if not impossible, for Venezuela and Iran and Yemen to acquire the medicine and other things that it needs to combat the virus, that I believe could be considered germ warfare.
Absolutely. I think these sanctions are weaponizing the coronavirus. They are illegal. They are immoral, you know, at a time when countries should be coming together to combat this.
I've got to stop you there. I'm sorry. I'm up against the clock. Dan Kovalik, as always, thank you so much for your time, for your contribution to this station. And thank you so much for coming on the Critical Hour, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, the corporate media spreads fake news claiming Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega is dead. Then he gives a fiery speech condemning U.S. militarism. This is according to the Gray Zone. International media outlets spent weeks falsely implying Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega died of coronavirus until he gave a televised speech defending socialized healthcare, calling for world peace, and criticizing U.S. military spending and nuclear weapons. This sounds eerily reminiscent of yesterday's claims of North Korean President Kim Jong-un's poor health. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She is the Code Pink Latin America coordinator. She is also a founder and coordinator for the Campaign to End U.S. and Canada Sanctions Against Venezuela, Terry Madsen. As always, Terry, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Well, it's wonderful to be back. Always enjoy our conversations.
Thank you. Thank you. So leading English and Spanish language publications spent weeks pumping out story after story, either implying or definitively reporting that Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega had died. Major newspapers from The Guardian to The Washington Post helped fuel the bogus rumor campaign. And then surprisingly, Ortega dispelled the fake news when he appeared about a week ago, and let me say, in person and alive, to deliver a fiery speech, rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated, in which he defended Nicaragua's socialized healthcare system, called for world peace, criticized the U.S. for spending so much money on war while its own citizens were dying due to lack of healthcare. Terry, first, your thoughts on what this says about the alleged independent media.
It's just so outrageous, isn't it? The propaganda is almost beyond being propaganda and is just a comedy, or, you know, a tragic comedy, quite honestly. But it's so outrageous. I will say I did watch Daniel Ortega's speech on the 15th, and I think it's really important, before we get too far into this conversation, to cite the reporting that Ben Norton is doing on the ground from Nicaragua on behalf of the Gray Zone. You read the lead of his recent article that we're talking about today. And it, you know, we're just so fortunate that media platforms like yours and like the Gray Zone exist so that we can talk about the absolute absurdity of some of the things happening in the mainstream media. And Ben is doing a fantastic job from the ground in Nicaragua right now. And I think we should just all recognize that. But the propaganda is outrageous. Ortega's talk on, or national address, I guess is better to call it, on the 15th was really, in true Ortega style, nothing more, nothing less. He is who he is, and he has had the same style since many of us first came to know him, you know, during the Sandinista Revolution in the 70s and then throughout the 80s in his first Sandinista government. So this is who the man is. I mean, most obviously, he's a lot older today, and so are all the rest of us. But that's by no means any reason to say, you know, he's dead. You know, the other person that has claimed that some of the alternative press has claimed to be dead, and falsely so, is President Moreno of Ecuador, because he has not been present either. And so it's very interesting to juxtapose what's happening in the neoliberal countries, economic, countries with neoliberal capitalism, and those that lean, more hybrid and even more fully socialized. I mean, we've talked about this before on your show, how this COVID-19 has really been manipulated to distract particularly the U.S. public from what's happening with U.S. foreign policy, and to take advantage of what is supposedly a pandemic and do, some dirty tricks. Specifically, we talked about, the narco trafficking, quote unquote, charges against Nicolas Maduro. And I think that's another example of this propaganda that supports neoliberal economies and governments and bashes those that are something different. And we see this with COVID-19 and this comparison or this attempt to malign Nicaragua and not malign the tragedy that has happened in Ecuador, and then with narco trafficking to malign the Venezuelan government and not, and not rightfully demean the actual narco trafficking state known as Honduras. So we see this in, multiple issues. It's the same tactic for the same, purpose.
Explain to the audience who is Daniel Ortega and why he is perceived by the right to be so dangerous.
Well, Daniel Ortega was one of several, I think nine military leaders that led the Sandinista Revolution through the 60s and 70s and ultimately ousted the U.S.-backed Somoza regime, two generations of Somozas running the Nicaraguan government and economy, fully backed by the United States. He and his, movement, military.
Ali North that was running that operation.
No. So the Sandinista Revolution got rid of the Somozas in 1979, and then the first Sandinista government, it was more of a junta style government, ran the country in the 80s, and that is the government that the U.S. tried to overthrow with you're thinking of the Iran-Contra operation that
right.
Oliver
okay.
North ran. And then you and I talked about that the irony of Nicolas Maduro being charged as a narco trafficker, that whole Iran-Contra cocaine sale being used to finance the U.S. Backed Contras, that was all led by a U.S. president named Ronald Reagan. So, there again is the hypocrisy, the irony, and the total propaganda manipulation. So that was in the 80s that they tried to get rid of him. And he was ultimately replaced electorally by the Chamorro government, which was a reinstallation of neoliberal capitalism. And the Chamorro years completely eroded all the gains of the Sandinista, of the first Sandinista government.
And it's important for the audience to understand Ortega was democratically elected.
Yeah, there we are. But according to whose definition of democratic?
Okay.
Who's defining democracy in this case? I mean, it's that definition comes from Washington, not from the people of Nicaragua who have created and defined their own form of democracy. So it just depends, right?
Gotcha.
On whose definition we use. And the U.S. is hell-bent on imposing its own form and its own definition of democracies throughout the world, I would argue, but specifically in the hemisphere of the Americas. The Monroe Doctrine 2.0.
So what is the U.S. interest in Nicaragua?
Well, I would first and foremost say that, the people, through a revolution and through an elected government, have very specifically told the United States and the world if they don't want to be governed, ruled by anyone other than themselves. They want, you know, to have their own people benefit from their government and their economy. They want to be able to decide what happens, you know, with their public infrastructure, what happens with their natural resources. And that doesn't happen when you, you know, when you've been basically colonized by the United States, or more appropriately, transnational corporations. And they want to say in their own destiny, in their own way. It's not that they don't want to work with the United States. They just want to be able to define that relationship on their own. The other thing that Nicaragua did during the early days of Chavismo and the presidency of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela is, you know, they joined the regional organization known as ALBA, which was basically an alliance between the Bolivarian countries of Latin America, meaning in Bolivarian, meaning those people, those nations that followed the Venezuelan model of progressive governments. And the name Bolivarian comes from Simon Bolivar, the liberator of Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Panama. He, you know, he liberated all six of those countries from Spain. And so that's, you know, that's the historical impetus of naming these countries Bolivarian, is throwing that yoke of empire off. And in those days, it was the Spanish Empire.
Let me jump in and just ask this. So does it come down to the simple reality that imperial powers, former or current colonial powers, cannot afford to have their subjects successfully revolt? We can tie this to...
I think that's the perfect way to put it. And it just depends on, you know, on how, what form of intervention you're talking about, because there's many forms, as we know, right? Especially nowadays, we have these, you know, multiple forms of hybrid warfare. So we have, you know, intense military interventionism, as we saw with a physical coup in Honduras in 2009. And then we have these orchestrated social media coups like we saw in Nicaragua in April of 2018. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the opposition in Nicaragua chose April of this year to accentuate Daniel Ortega and his supposed lack of response to COVID-19. It was right around the, you know, 2-year anniversary of that initial coup attempt. But yeah, there's various forms to influence and keep, you know, the U.S. model, specifically the U.S. economic model, in place in countries. And that is totally to benefit global capital and transnational corporations. And people have every right to say no.
Well, as they are sovereign nations, and we understand that sovereignty is the ability to control and use military force to control the goings-ons within your defined geographic space and without influence and pressure from outside entities. And the United States, as well as other colonial interests, don't seem to be able to tolerate that when it comes to socialist-based governments.
You know, here's the irony of this about, you know, nations wanting their own sovereignty to, you know, determine their own destiny. Well, the United States wants that as well. I mean, it's one of the reasons we fought our country fought the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want anyone interfering with our nation's affairs. So much so that in 1823, the president of the United States declared the Monroe Doctrine, saying, you know, no foreign interests should be in this hemisphere that are opposed to, you know, United States goals. And it's just so ironic. And at that point, you know, they were specifically referencing, you know, Spain, England, mm-hmm. and France, particularly England. So today, do you remember last April of 19, I believe it was, when John Bolton was in Miami and at a meeting with Bay of Pigs veterans, I believe, and, you know, said, you know, I want to say loud and clear, the Monroe Doctrine is alive and well. Today, you know, in the 21st century, digging up this doctrine from 1823. And of course, he was talking, you know, not about England, France, and Spain. He's talking, you know, China, Russia, and others. And those countries are major trading partners of many nations in Latin America.
And it's important to point out as we get out here that Bolton saying that at a meeting in Florida underlines the domestic politics that all of this impacts, as Florida has become one of the key swing states. And there are a lot of Euro-Venezuelan, Nicaraguan individuals, Cubans, living in Florida. And that's the audience that the Marco Rubios and the others are playing to. Terry Matson, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your insight. Look forward to having you back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.